Thank you, Mr. Dangerfield. I must say it is a great honor to be with you tonight for the purpose of delivering the James Lecture and to help you celebrate the golden anniversary of the Graduate College of the University of Illinois. I must say, however, that when I found out that this is the James Lecture in Government, it was with some trepidation that I finally managed to muster up enough courage to come to Urbana. Tonight, I was taken to dinner by a large group of political scientists, and I must say I was reminded of a story which a Hungarian friend of mine told about a friend of his, Ferenc Molnár, the great Hungarian playwright. It seems that Molnár was quite the night owl. He usually stayed up until 2, 3, 4 in the morning, maybe even later. Very seldom got up before noon, usually not until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And on one occasion, he had to appear as a witness in a lawsuit. His lawyer came to his apartment at 8:30 in the morning to pick him up, managed to get him breakfasted and out on the street that hour. Molnár looked at all of this rushing up and down, all of these people on the street, and he turned to his lawyer and he said, "Are all of these people witnesses?" And tonight over dinner, I looked down this long table and I thought to myself, are all these people political scientists? And factories and communication systems for our continued existence. The problem of survival has been transformed into a fantastic assortment of problems, all of which are interrelated and all of which must be recognized and solved if human beings are going to continue to inhabit the earth. The days of Neanderthal simplicity are gone, yet with monotonous regularity, we, here in the United States, attempt to reduce our problem to Stone Age primitiveness. We search for simple answers in a world which unfortunately presents us only with complex problems. At the moment, we are confronted by what is called the Soviet threat. The Soviet Union has become to us what the beast was to Neanderthal man. And our addiction to oversimplification has led us to justify practically everything that we do or don't do on the basis of what the Soviet Union does or does not do. I would like to stress at the outset that this, I believe, is an extremely dangerous attitude. The dangers which are inherent in the present deadlock between the United States and the Soviet Union are, of course, enormous. But we should not permit our concern with the Soviet Union to cause us to ignore the other serious threats which we face. I have had the good fortune of being invited to deliver two lectures this week, one last Sunday in Minneapolis, and the other this evening here in Urbana. I say good fortune because there are many things I want to say about the problems of survival, indeed, far more than I can say in a single lecture. In Minneapolis, I confine my remarks primarily to a discussion of the possible consequences of our present policies with respect to the Soviet Union, and I placed primary emphasis upon our attitude toward nuclear weapons. In my lecture tonight, I would like to place primary emphasis upon the problems which confront us outside of the area of military technology, problems which are not quite so obvious, yet which are, I believe, fully as critical for us as a nation and as members of the community of mankind. In our modern scientific technological world, it is, of course, impossible to divorce completely the problems of military technology and disarmament from the other problems which face us. All are interrelated, and they cannot, in the long run, be solved separately. Therefore, although I am going to speak tonight primarily about problems of a non-military nature, I would like to spend the first few moments outlining some of my views concerning our present policies with respect to nuclear weapons. Our present policies are apparently based upon several premises. First, it is assumed that a strong strategic nuclear striking power, sufficient to destroy any nation which might strike at us, represents the most reliable deterrent to the outbreak of large-scale nuclear war. Second, it is assumed that our nuclear striking power will not remain adequate, particularly in the new age of missiles, unless we maintain a vigorous program of nuclear weapon development aimed at devising a variety of weapons ranging from tactical devices to intercontinental anti-aircraft and anti-missile devices of various kinds. Third, it is assumed that we will, at least for many decades ahead, be confronted by little wars, and that we must be prepared to fight these wars using nuclear tactical weapons in such a way that the little wars do not become big ones. In this connection, it is taken for granted, but seldom explicitly stated, that it is considerably less expensive to achieve a given level of tactical military power using nuclear weapons than to achieve the same level of power using ordinary explosives. Fourth, it is assumed that nuclear disarmament and associated with it a cessation of nuclear tests is impossible because one could not be certain that tests were not being conducted by a potential enemy in secret. In answer to the criticism that the testing of nuclear devices causes the deaths of a substantial number of human beings each year as a result of radioactive fallout, the proponents of our present policies argue that the resultant deaths are few in number when compared with the deaths which occur each year from natural causes. They argue further that we must balance against these deaths the consequences of our failure to maintain a vigorous nuclear weapons development program. I believe that our present policies with respect to nuclear weapons are wrong, in part because I believe that the premises are in large measure wrong, and in part because the premises do not take into account the technological evolution which will in all likelihood take place in the world during the course of the next few decades. I also believe that there is a very real moral problem involved, concerning which we have given all too little thought. It cannot be denied easily that human beings are being killed by bomb testing. It seems to me that it makes little difference whether we call the number large or small. The fact remains that individual human beings are being killed at random by these actions. Most of the persons who are killed live outside of the United States, Great Britain, and the USSR. All of us in the three nations involved must realize that we are establishing a precedent, and I frankly shudder at what the long-range consequences of that precedent might be for humanity as a whole if we carry it to its ultimate conclusion. But to return to the premises, I believe that the view that we can rely upon our ability to retaliate with devastating effectiveness to prevent all-out nuclear war, and that we can at the same time wage limited nuclear war, is fallacious. The major factor which negates this view, I believe, is that we will, in the not too far distant future, be confronted by a number of nations, each of which possesses the ability of manufacturing and using nuclear weapons. It seems to me that the United States, England, and the Soviet Union, the nations which now possess nuclear capabilities in the military weapons field, could agree quite easily upon a plan for cessation of tests, which could be monitored satisfactorily without jeopardizing other aspects of military security, and which would effectively slow down, but not necessarily halt, the development of military nuclear technology in other parts of the world. Most of us would agree, I believe, that even a slowing down of progress in this area is something very much to be desired. In my Minneapolis talk, I suggested a possible sequence of steps which, if taken, would ease the present critical situation, I believe, and which would create an atmosphere within which long-range goals could be pursued. These steps would involve, first, an agreement to stop all nuclear testing for a short period of from 1 to 3 years. During this interval, an international group of scientists knowledgeable in the military nuclear technology field would meet and draw up the specifications for a worldwide network of monitoring stations, spaced, for example, at 1,000-mile intervals over the Earth's surface and under UN control, and equipped with the most sensitive equipment available for detecting air and ground waves and radiation. Once it is agreed that such a network should be established, the agreement to stop testing could be placed upon a permanent basis, but with a peculiar but nevertheless extremely important loophole attached to the agreement. It is argued by the proponents of our present policies that the nature of a democratic society is such that were we involved in an agreement of this sort, we would not attempt to bootleg tests. But the Russians, it is argued, might well embark upon a program aimed at conducting tests in secret. It is also argued that our new nuclear military laboratories, such as Los Alamos and Livermore, would disintegrate, while the Russians would be able to maintain their laboratories intact. This difficulty can be circumvented, it seems to me, were we to agree that all tests which cannot be detected by the established monitoring system are legal. This would mean that the Russians and the Americans would be placed on an equal footing, and both nations could feel free to establish crash programs aimed at determining whether or not the severe testing restrictions might be circumvented.